I am speaking to you at a moment of grave crisis.
I'm Jeff Turner, and this is Recall. It's a series about history. Not the ancient past, but history that's still hot to the touch. In this first season, I explore a revolutionary political movement that brought a modern democracy to the brink. You can find Recall, How to Start a Revolution, on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Coming up on The Cost of Living.
There are so many fewer people in the workforce per retiree than there were when I was born, and that is a scary number, and it's a scary number. It's a number that should scare all of us.
That's Immigration Minister Mark Miller making the demographic argument for Canada's shift in immigration policy. It's a big change, and it's taking heat. Hi, I'm Paul Havertrude. Welcome to The Cost of Living. A record surge in immigration has been blamed for adding to a lot of problems, like putting pressure on housing and healthcare. Now, the federal government is dialing back the number of temporary residents coming into the country. Later in the show, we ask Immigration Minister Mark Miller if Canada tried to do too much, too fast. Also today, do you ever buy something at a store and get asked for your email address? Maybe they dangle a discount if you sign up for something. What is it about your email that they want it so badly? Up first, new rules around pay transparency were supposed to make life easier for job hunters. So, are they working? So do you remember, Danielle Nerman, how you felt the last time you were looking for a job?
Not great. I remember I got an interview, which was nice, but it took 3 weeks to get a call back.
That waiting? That's tough.
Yeah, it's the worst part. And, you know, some employers, they try to make that better. They'll tell you exactly when they're going to call, like, we'll call you next week. And the job postings themselves, they can be really precise. They can say what kind of experience you need and how much the job pays.
Well, they can be like that, but they're not always like that.
No. And when Kate McKenzie was looking for work last spring, her job hunt came with a lot of unknowns. She saw listings for jobs she really liked, but she had no idea what kind of pay they were offering.
It's frustrating because it leaves this whole room for guessing. You look at the title, you're trying to evaluate based on who's posted and what the responsibilities are to see, is this going to bring in the salary that I need for myself and my family? And you just don't know because there's nothing there to give you any indication.
Okay, so she was just kind of floating around in all this uncertainty. But what about the idea of pay transparency? I mean, new rules have come in. Weren't they supposed to deal with exactly the kinds of issues that she faced?
Yeah, and we are seeing a movement for more pay transparency. And what this is, the thinking behind it is that if everyone is open about what they pay, it's more fair. And we just had Ontario pass legislation last month. BC, Newfoundland, and PEI, they already have pay transparency laws in place. And a new report shows those rules are starting to work. According to the job posting site Indeed.com, listings that show salary information have more than doubled in the last 5 years.
Well, that seems good.
It does, but this is the thing. There might be more pay transparency, but just how transparent it is, that's up for debate.
Well, how so?
So even though there's been this rise in job ads that say what the compensation is, they don't all advertise exact salaries. They show a salary range. So instead of saying the pay is $80,000, it will say it's somewhere between 70 and 100 grand.
That's like a $30,000 gap. That's a pretty big difference.
It is. And according to this report, as pay transparency becomes more of a thing, the salary ranges being advertised have been getting wider. Darcy Clark is a compensation expert in Montreal with the HR firm Normandie Beaudry.
I've seen some crazy ones. We see like $50,000 to $200,000. Well, that's far too wide. I mean, technically, by definition, it's transparent, but it's misleading.
Well, he says misleading, but isn't it just kind of meaningless?
Yeah, it can be. I mean, look at it. Someone's looking for a job that pays $50,000 a year will have very different skills than someone who wants to make $200K. And Kate McKenzie says if you're looking for work, giant salary ranges can cause other problems.
You go in there and you feel this expectation that you're supposed to somehow undersell yourself, that in order for you to get the job, you're going to have to be in the lower end of that range. And so basically, it's a race to the bottom between you and other candidates, rather than it being about where your skills are truly at and where your experience is truly at.
So she feels like there's this pressure on people just to take, you know, whatever money is being offered just so they can get their foot in the door.
When you're looking for work, it's stressful. If you have bills stacking up, a mortgage to pay, you might just take whatever they offer. But employers don't always post a wide range because they're looking to pay someone less. A company may just want to make sure people apply, especially if the labor market is tight. I talked to several HR experts about this. They said if a company is having a hard time filling roles, it may use a bigger pay range as a way of getting more applicants.
So they're basically just trying to cast as wide a net as possible.
That's the idea. But employers have to be careful with this strategy. Because if people know what a job could pay, things could backfire. Christine Kuhn is a professor of management at Washington State University.
You might have people that are attracted by the very high end of the range that, though, when they actually go through the process and then they get an offer at the lower end of the range, then they're offended and then they turn you down. And that makes the whole process less efficient for everybody.
Yeah, if you get offered $50,000, but you're kind of thinking, hey, I'm a six-figure kind of employee, you're not going to be stoked.
No, it really can send the wrong signal. And it's not just the wrong signal going to the applicant who gets that lowball offer. A wide salary range can also send bad vibes to job hunters even before they decide to apply. Christine published a study about this recently in the Journal of Applied Psychology. And what she did was she conducted an experiment with around 650 people. And she asked them how they perceive job ads with different salary ranges. So narrow salary ranges, people were generally okay with. But really wide ranges of 50 grand or higher?
Most people tended to take that as that's just kind of ludicrous. That this is ridiculous. I doubt they actually pay anybody that much, even if they're really well qualified. And so you are sending a negative signal to most people by having that very wide range.
Also, Christine says people felt distrust towards companies that advertised big pay ranges, which is the exact opposite of what pay transparency is supposed to do. It's meant to create more trust, not less.
You may be complying with the law, but you are not actually conveying useful information to potential applicants. And so it does counteract the intended spirit of the legislation. And so, no, I would say that is not transparent.
But not every job posting is like this. Some are really open and upfront and say exactly what they pay.
What kind of jobs do that?
It's really common for jobs that pay hourly. A security guard or a barista, the pay is going to be precise, like we pay $18 an hour. But Darcy Clark, the compensation expert, says that's not how annual salaries work. The compensation you get can vary a lot, even within the same job.
Yeah, ranges don't exist just in job postings. They exist in real life on how companies manage compensation, their framework. So think about colleagues or jobs you've had where there's more than one person doing your job. Not everyone is paid exactly the same amount. They're within the range. And that's because people have different experiences, capabilities, or potential.
So he's talking about jobs that might have a pay scale or something like pay bands. You start at one spot, get more experience, work your way up the band.
Exactly. And when you see a job listing that shows a salary range, Darcy says what you're seeing more often than not is how you would be compensated in a role over time.
Well, sure, that's understandable. You know, the more experience you have, the more money you're probably going to make. Mm-hmm. But it's also a lot to take in if you're someone who's just applying for jobs and looking at a job posting. You're saying, you know, should I apply for this job? Should I not? If we were just to take the best parts of pay transparency, how would this ideally work?
Darcy says job postings would be straight up. Employers would post what they realistically would pay for the role, from the low end to the high end. And they wouldn't pad it out just to attract more people. And that is something that Kate McKenzie has really taken to heart. Remember, she was looking for a job and she found one. And now she's doing some of the hiring herself.
So she got a job. All right. Where?
With a nonprofit in Calgary, Big Brothers, Big Sisters. And Kate says some of the stuff she saw happening with pay transparency when she was looking for work, it really frustrated her. So she helped her organization make some changes to the way they advertise jobs, like making sure the salary ranges are narrow.
So we're looking to try to keep our ranges now between 5 and 10,000. And my hope is that by listing a really clear salary range, that it's actually going to attract the right kind of candidate. And so they've already decided this is a salary they feel comfortable with and one that meets their cost of living and their needs.
Well, it's one employer down.
Yeah, but a lot more to go for pay transparency to actually do what it's supposed to.
Thanks, Danielle.
You're welcome.
On your radio and by podcast, this is The Cost of Living. I'm Paul Havershrood. As a rule, no one likes to be rude, especially to someone just doing their job. But sometimes you're at a store, you're trying to check out, and they ask you for your email address. Maybe they offer a discount if you sign up for something. And it's like, no, you can't have it. Stop asking. But our producer, Ellis Cho, says don't expect stores to stop asking anytime soon.
You're out shopping. You go to the till to pay. Pull out your MasterCard and...
Can I just grab your email for the receipt?
Seems like everyone wants your email address these days. And Val Robbins is not having it.
Well, it's kind of annoying. And it's not like I'm often in a rush, but it's a bit intrusive or really intrusive. And I didn't go into a store to have to give all my information. I just wanted to buy something.
Val's retired, lives in Kelowna, and loves to shop. She used to share her email address until spam took over her inbox.
Like, I could go through my email right now and I probably have 50 or 60 from places that I've been or checked into, or they, you know, and then it's difficult to unsubscribe from some.
John Kurt Plenusen teaches digital marketing at Queen's University. He says emails cost companies virtually nothing to send and allow them to get one-on-one with their customers.
They want to let you know about all of their specials, their promotions, to turn you from a one-time customer into a client.
Emails also allow retailers to track you. Every click you make sends them information. What you like, what you ignore, and in return, you can end up with offers catered just for you.
Because it allows the company to learn more about you and what you like and what you don't like, so they can do a good job of putting a smile on your face.
But they gotta get that email first. Because of anti-spam laws, shops need your consent to get your email. It's why store websites ask for your email address. And cashiers ask for it when you buy something. And sometimes they ask for it when you return something. But legally, you have no obligation to give it. Jane Arnett is with cybersecurity company Checkpoint. She says it can be uncomfortable to say no, but...
That one email address is potentially tied to a lot of things about you, depending. Think about how many places online you've used that email address to sign up for something.
She's not worried about retailers and what they do with email addresses.
I'm more worried about when that corporation gets hacked and that information gets taken. Yeah. And then it's what it's what those people are doing with that data that scares me the most.
In the last decade, Indigo, Saks Fifth Avenue, Home Depot, they've all been hacked. An email address can reveal your name. It can be linked to your social media accounts, your employment history, apps, or your favorite websites. And all of that makes it easier to steal your identity. But if you really can't resist that extra 10% off for signing up, then Jane says, set up a separate email account. One that doesn't include your name or is connected to anything important, like your bank account. Now, if you're like Val Robbins, you might have a different approach.
I just make an email address up, like notgoingtohappen@gmail.com, fu@fu.com. I try not to use ones that might get me in trouble, like robinbanks@gmail.com.
For the cost of living, I'm Ellis Cho.
Do you mind handing out your email address or phone number when you're checking out at a store? Give us a call and let us know. Our number is 1-866-550-COST. That's 1-866-550-2678.
Hello, I'm Jess Milton. For 15 years, I produced The Vinyl Cafe with the late, great Stuart McLean. Every week, more than 2 million people tuned in to hear funny, fictional, feel-good stories about Dave and his family. We're excited to welcome you back to the warm and welcoming world of The Vinyl Cafe with our new podcast, Backstage at The Vinyl Cafe. Each week, we'll share two hilarious stories by Stuart, and for the first time ever, I'll tell you what it was like behind the scenes. Subscribe for free wherever you get your podcasts.
This is The Cost of Living. I'm Paul Habershrood. When Mark Miller took over as federal immigration minister last summer, Canada's plan to boost the number of permanent residents to 500,000 a year was well on its way. And that was on top of more than a million temporary residents also coming in. The thinking behind this rush of new people comes back to demographics. Canada's population is aging, and that can be a trap for a country and its economy. But this surge in immigration has also happened along with a housing crunch, full schools, overflowing hospitals. Did the country try to do too much too fast? Mark Miller, the Federal Minister of Immigration, Refugees and Citizenship, joins us now. Minister Miller, hello.
Hello.
Right now, it feels like a lot of roads for the Canadian economy lead back to immigration. In fact, a lot of roads for Canada lead back to immigration. So let me start by asking this. Do you have the hardest job in Canadian politics right now?
I've spent a lot of time with my colleagues, and I know how hard their jobs are. I came out of one that was pretty difficult, so I wouldn't say that. I will say that there are a lot of challenges that we are facing as a country built on immigration. It's certainly been one of the hotter issues in the last year, in particular. I would say, unfortunately, because of the rise in issues that matter to Canadians like affordability, eyes are correspondingly turned on numbers that are associated at times with immigration, whether it's temporary or permanent. And I think we're in a point in our history where I think we could still have a very important, responsible conversation on a number of things that touch and concern immigration generally, the immigration system, which is a different concept, and also the border and how we regulate it in a responsible way. Canada is a country that's built on that consensus. I've said this before, and I'll continue to say it because I feel it to be true, is that we have gotten perhaps complacent about the value of that. And to the extent that it's tied into the economy, as you mentioned, that's right. 60% of our migration is economic in nature compared to something like 25% in the U.S. So these are important things that I think we have to have reasonable conversations. Otherwise, they kind of will probably tilt into the unreasonable.
So Canada's immigration plan is to boost permanent residents to 500,000. But when you add in temporary residents, so like international students, asylum seekers, TFWs, that's another 1 million-plus people. When you think about things on the temporary side, Minister, how did they end up rushing ahead so quickly?
You know, there's many folds to that, Paul. Anyone that's been following the news in Canada has noted that jump as it occurred in with respect to international students. And that certainly has been one of the driving factors. We have also seen that in the temporary foreign worker space, whether it's in the manufacturing fields, in the agricultural sectors. Those are and have seen jumps that are significant. I think the question we have to ask ourselves as a country, particularly in a context of food inflation, is whether we can afford to reduce those in a way that doesn't cause further inflation. But clearly that chunk of the population that's jumped from 2.5% to 6-7% is something that is significant. It is the result of students that are here, asylum seekers that are here, all coming in numbers that are significant. The challenge I think we have to face is how do we reduce those in a responsible, rational way without being heartless, but also transition them into some level of permanence. I think the mental error that we tend to make is to assume that that group of people that are here temporarily never becomes permanent. That's not true. A good chunk of them actually do. And well, they should, particularly when you're talking about younger segments of the working population, which there are so many fewer people in the workforce per retiree than there were when I was born. And that is a scary number. And it's a scary number. It's a number that should scare all of us. If we want all the benefits that we are so proud of in Canada, we need people working and paying taxes.
Sure, and that demographic argument makes sense, but at the same time, people were looking at the numbers. Economists were looking at the numbers. A lot of people that, you know, we've both talked to, and they were ringing alarm bells, and they were ringing them loudly. They're saying, hey, we're all for immigration. Let's be clear about that. But too much too fast is going to cause the pressures you talked about on housing, on healthcare, on schools. Why didn't the government listen to those warnings?
Yeah, and look, I think we can all... And I, when you talk about putting responsibility and guilt, I think it's important to shoulder it when it's appropriate. I think it's also important to recognize where we are ambitious in our public policies and don't necessarily fully appreciate and play out what impacts that can have. I'll give you a couple simple examples of this. Every year I have to, as a matter of law, put forward my annual levels that deal with the permanent aspects of this program, and did so in the fall. When provinces look at the levels that I announced, they don't necessarily adjust immediately. They have their own political motivations. They don't necessarily say, oh, we're going to build more schools, we're going to do this, we're going to do that, even though they have the benefit of the fiscal and tax base of these new immigrants and the capital that they bring in, since 60% of it is economic migration. But governments don't necessarily plan accordingly. And that's just the reality of things. So can we do things better? Absolutely. I think in a lot of areas, we've done a really good job in making the population, the working population base better. The Bank of Canada has highlighted that significantly, which is important compared to our peers. But I think what Canadians have told us time and time again about when we do strategic reviews is, yes, governments need to do a better job in planning and preparing for these things, which I don't think anyone regrets, but that do come with a complex set of repercussions.
If you look at housing, where was the breakdown in terms of bringing people in and then the troubles that that the housing market at least has had in integrating those numbers?
I think we have to sort of have a distinction between correlation, causation. This is a story that started 40 years ago. Governments stopped investing in housing. And so we did that as we got into power. Initially, not enough. You've seen us pulling out all the stops recently. But 8 years is a relatively short period of time in a 40-year cycle. So this is something that we should have probably done as a federal government in a sustained fashion over three to four decades. That is undeniable. And that, I feel, has to continue. It has to go with proper investments that do come with the provinces and territories. The other thing that I would highlight is that when we talk about the impact of immigration and its association to affordability, to make some very important distinctions. I've said this often, that immigrants didn't cause the rise in interest rates, but there's no denying at the same time, and I don't think we should deny, that the impact of that volume does have impact, and we have to plan for it, and that is something that we're doing increasingly. It's going to require a lot more planning and a lot more work from provinces in particular, and us actually coordinating ourselves.
Well, you've mentioned how foundational immigration is to the country and the Canadian experience. And you know, I know you've seen the polling that shows that feelings about immigration are turning more negative. And this is something that's happening on your watch. Do you feel some responsibility for that?
Oh, as a government official, as the Minister of Immigration, I think the responsibility is mine to assume. It is also, I think, more importantly, based on what I hear from Canadians, it's our job as a government to fix. The steps that we've taken in the last month have been described by some as some of the most important affordability steps that the government has done. So I think that's important. I think even more importantly, because we have spoken about affordability, is to talk about the integrity of the system and the steps that we need to take to make sure that we can have an immigration system that we continue to be proud of. I still believe that we can have a rational, reasonable conversation about three parts of the immigration system that tend to get conflated. One, obviously the border, which is obviously can get quite heated at times because we need to be able to defend and secure our borders. Two, the immigration system, which has its challenges, particularly post-COVID. And three, immigration generally. You can be for one of those categories against the other, and I'm not going to call you a bigot or someone that's xenophobic. We have to be able to echo and hear those concerns and talk to Canadians about what their fears are. Often when you break things down to their parts, you can have a rational conversation with people about those challenges, and you can agree to disagree. I'm not going to make a big sermon to someone who has a disagreement with me on these issues, because Lord knows I've had them around the Christmas table and I continue to have them. But it's something I think we can't shy away from as a country, or we can get into that toxic political narrative that we see sadly to the south of us.
Well, Minister Miller, thank you.
Thanks for having me on, Paul.
Mark Miller is the Federal Minister of Immigration, Refugees and Citizenship. That's all for this week. The Cost of Living is based in Calgary. And hey, here's something new. You can now listen to the show on YouTube. Just go to the CBC News page, scroll down a bit, and boom, there we are. What a world. The show is produced by Daniel Nerman, Ellis Cho, and Jennifer Keane, with help from Caroline Ferris. Our executive producer is Tracy Johnson. I'm Paul Habershrood. Thanks for listening.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.